starting in verse 3 of chapter 1. So chapter 1, verse 3, through chapter 2, verse 3, basically records what we tend to call creation week. And if you believe in the gap theory, we refer to it as recreation week. And again, I don't want to bog down in that. But one of the things I want to say is it's worth us realizing as we read this, the perspective. The perspective is from Earth's surface. So things aren't described as though you're out in space watching it. It's described as though you're here and suddenly things are happening, you know, without always explaining the how and why. Although it's always saying God did it, but it doesn't say exactly how he did some things. There is a logical format. There's some interesting progression in a sense. Days 1 through 3 sort of fit together in days 4 through 6, and then day 7 is on its own. And there's some corresponding elements between those two stages. Like both days 1 and day 4 both deal with something going on in the heavens. Day 2 and day 5 both deal with what's going on in the waters. And day 3 and day 6 both deal with things going on in the land. And to me, that's one of those things sometimes scholars say, oh, look, it's sort of a pattern. Ah, cool. But other than it's kind of cool, it's not something to focus too much on. There, you know, some people, and even some who profess to believe the Bible is true, speculate that these days, so-called, are actually great epics of evolution covering millions of years. I don't believe for a second that's true. And Charlie and I totally agree on that. We're talking about literal days. And for a couple of reasons. One is, even though this isn't a scientific description per se, there are elements of science that just wouldn't fit for it being thousands of years. Some in particular, like many plants depend on insects and birds for pollinization. So if you had plants appear and it wasn't until thousands of years later honeybees come along, we wouldn't have those plants still today. But if God created plants one day and it's a couple days later, here are the insects, well, they can survive that long. It's also worth noting the Hebrew grammar supports this. Now, it's worth noting some scholars who are critics of the Bible will say the Hebrew word day, yom, Y-O-M, can mean a 24-hour period, but it can also mean a period of time. And we use it that way in English. The day of the Lord, you know, doesn't always mean a 24-hour period. It means a, you know, an epic or a some period. But whenever in Hebrew day and night are both referenced, it means 24 hours. And we often compare what we see here to the story of Jonah. Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish. And Christ said, in the same way Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth. And he doesn't mean just some indiscriminate periods. He means 3 24-hour periods. And in the creation week account, we see the evening and the morning were the first day. Evening and the morning were the second day. When the Hebrews presented like that, it means 24 hours. So both the grammar and science support the idea that this is 1 week. Okay, so having said that, we'll move. Oh, there is one thing I forgot to mention earlier when I talked about God in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I heard some people discussing, well, that doesn't fit with the Big Bang, like it's spattered all over. But it does support the idea that science now agrees there was a starting point to the universe. And I'm making the distinction because historically, you can go back enough in history, there was a time when science believed that the universe always was. I'm old enough that I had textbooks where they said there are two theories for the existence of the universe, the Big Bang theory and what they called the steady state theory. The steady state just meant it's always been here. Well, the Bible doesn't agree with that. The Bible says God created it. Yeah, and science has supported the idea of what they call the Big Bang, which at least means it wasn't there and then it was. And so science agrees with Genesis in that sense, that it started at some point in time. They disagree on a lot of other things, but what I've said before is the more science looks at things, the more it agrees with the Bible rather than disagree. Okay, so let's move on to verse 3. Then God said, you know, let there be light. The then God said is referring, it could have been translated, then God decreed. Or it could say, then God ordered, God appointed. But God is saying and it's happening. And let there be light. and God saw the light, it was good. God divided the light from the darkness. He called the light day, the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Now there's different discussion of what happened when he said, let there be light. Remember I said, we're on the surface of the earth. So a lot of people think there was some type of opaque covering, maybe thick vapor, perhaps water, whatever, that then was cleared. Most scholars don't think that God at that point created the sun. Although, Charlie, I don't know if younger theorists believe they... It could be argued either way. Most people interpret it as the light gets through.
When it says here, so the evening and the morning were the first day. So yeah. It, that be a 24-hour period as God yeah, didn't words, spend 20 years making...
No, he didn't make 20
light.
Years making their light. I've sometimes wondered, it's like, boy, that's... He describes him making a whole lot of things the other days. This day there's light. I don't know if he just didn't want to do more. There's questions we don't have answers.
I never really thought about light. I always just figured light just meant the sun.
Yeah, well, we believe it's light from the sun.
Could have been light from his
the
face.
The question is, it could be light being through. One thing that's important, the evening and the morning, there's suddenly day and night. We could speculate if the earth was not already rotating, now it is. Maybe it already was, but now for certain, the earth is rotating, and we've had day and night ever since then. Oh, that's a consistency we might take for granted, but we shouldn't. God made it to be that way, and it's very important. Matter of fact, you can make a reference, Jeremiah 33 and verse 20. In Jeremiah 33, God references a promise that he made to King David, and he says, as long as there's day and night, I'll keep this promise. And so, okay, the fact that day and night isn't something you have to take for granted, but God is saying it is going to keep going. So he sort of makes that promise. Matter of fact, a little closer to this, Genesis 8:22 says, while the earth remains, day and night shall not cease. So God makes a promise. I started the day-night cycle, and it's going to keep going. And it has. You know, nobody's really questioned that. Okay, moving on in verse 6. Then God said, same thing, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. That word for firmament is rakia. R-A-K-I-A is a way to transliterate it. And it could also be translated an expanse. It comes from a word that means spreading out. So basically, it's referring to God creating the atmosphere. So he created a firmament. It means a space. Because I've always thought firmament means something firm. And I get confused because later it talks about raising the dry land out of the waters. This isn't the land. It's talking about the atmosphere. And it'll say he separated... divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. What's the waters above the firmament? Well, one answer is clouds. I was talking to my son Connor today about how clouds are made out of water, and he thought that was mind-boggling. Now, there is speculation, which we'll come back to later. Some people speculate that it was more than clouds. I've heard some people say even something that some have referred to as a water canopy, thicker water, and I don't know. I'm not going to say it's not possible, but maybe. But one thing, there's water down here, there's an expanse, which we'll call an atmosphere, and there's some form of water above. Water is the one substance that we're familiar with that can exist on Earth in three different forms. You know, solid ice, liquid water, and gaseous water vapor. So when it says water's above, there's room to debate. I doubt that it was an iceberg up there, you know. But, you know, we don't have to know some of those things. And God called the firmament heaven. So that firmament, as I said, heaven, atmosphere. We discussed three heavens earlier. So the evening and the morning were the second day. So we've got that. As I said, the second day deals with the heavens. Let me move on here. Verse 9. Then God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered in one place and let dry land appear. This is one of the things that one place makes some people believe in Pangaea. Others would say the grammar doesn't mean it has to be all one place, but it means let there be water where there's water and land where there's land. No, I don't know that I don't disbelieve in Pangaea. I'm just not sure that this requires it, but it would support it. So it's one of those things we don't need to know. Again, if I could go and ask God, say, couldn't you write it in here so we know for certain? No, I'm not going to bother. I got more important things to write. So, and let me move on then, because he gets them all in one place, and he's not done here. Yeah, he called the dry land earth, gathering the waters he called seas. It's good, but he's not done this day. Verse 11, God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, the fruit seed that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself and in the earth. The earth also brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, tree that yields fruit, and it goes on. So God saw that it was good. I like to make the point here because it mentions yielding seed. Plants sometimes reproduce by other means. You know, spores, which to me are kind of like seeds. Some plants send out runners. This, again, is not meant to be a scientific description saying, okay, this is the, you know, all the ways plants reproduce. But it is making the case that God created plants to reproduce. He only created plant life once, as far as we know. And I'll make that case when we talk about Noah's flood. God has Noah build the ark, bring all the animals in. God could have said, let's just kill all the animals and I'll create new ones. But God seemed to want to preserve this creation as a unique event. He didn't want to create plants again and animals again, or at least it doesn't seem that he did. And we could question what your motives, what we don't know, but he made plants to reproduce. He'll make animals to reproduce. So he built that in and he made a variety of ways to do it. If you go down to bacteria, there's mitosis. Is that what you call it when they split? Aren't you glad he didn't make us to reproduce that way? That'd be weird. Okay, moving on. And of course, here it begins saying God saw it was good. The meaning there, good, it means beneficial. And it begins, we'll start seeing these things are going to be beneficial to mankind as well. That's sort of an implied meaning that we can read into it without making too big of a deal of it. Okay, verse 13, the evening and the morning were the third day. So we move into the fourth day, and God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night. Well, we've already seen there was day from night. So some people have gone back and said, was that the sun when he said, let there be light? I think it is, but there's room to question. And if I'm wrong and sun doesn't appear till here, we could say, well, the light's from something else. We don't know for certain. I believe the sun was there. What I think, here's my explanation, is that God lets more light come through. I believe all those stars were out there, because in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. I believe the stars were there. Perhaps now he's making it so the light can be seen. And he's designating their purpose more than anything else. To divide the day from night, let them be for signs and seasons, for days and years. Let them be lights in the firmament of heavens to give light on earth. And it was so. Okay, so I think we could say that if it had not been there before, at this point, we have a calendar. Signs, seasons, days, and years. And how do the calendars from ancient times have been determined by the movement of the celestial bodies? And still are, really. The Earth's rotating around its axis. It's circling the sun. The moon revolves around the Earth. And all these things are moving, and our calendars are based on that. The reason I'm pausing here is there is, and has been for decades, for hundreds of years, significant argument about the calendar. The reason it matters is we believe some days are holy and other days are not. How do we know we're keeping the right days? Well, I don't want to get into, we will discuss the calendar later this year, but my belief is that it came from God. And I think it's ordained from this time. And I'll mention at least one of my arguments is that it's tied to the movement of these bodies. And God made everything in an organized manner. It moves at a certain rate, and the laws of physics can determine it. Matter of fact, it's been 2 or 3 or 4 years now. We had a probe intersect with Pluto. You know, we sent it out there, and it traveled for years and years and gets close enough to take these pictures of Pluto. It's like, that's mind-boggling. It's billions of miles away, and it's moving in an arc, and we're moving this way, and you got to aim this rocket. How could we do that? Well, for one thing, the scientists knew where Pluto would be and when, and they knew all the other bodies, and they could account for their gravity. And it's consistent. And what I'm saying is we can calculate the progression of the days, weeks, months, and years, You know, we can calculate it, and it has been. It's tied to those bodies, but it can be calculated thousands of years in the future, thousands of years in the past. We don't have to wonder. You don't have to travel to Jerusalem and go, can I see the moon today or not, to know what day of the week it is. It can be calculated. And again, I'm saying Genesis is the origin story of many things. I think we have an origin of a calendar. What it does not tell us is when mankind figured it out, or did God hand them? Did he hand them a flip calendar with pictures of cats in interesting poses? Probably not, you know. And he didn't give them a Julian or a Gregorian calendar such as we use today. You know, the Hebrews, and it turns out the Babylonians and others used, you know, a lunisolar calendar, which is basically what we follow with the holy days. I'm getting sidetracked more than I wanted to, but I want to make the point that we see the origin, we don't see all the detail that we wish there were that would eliminate some arguments in the church. Instead, God moves on to what he does next. And verse 20, then God said, you know, after we finish the fourth day, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly across the earth in the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures, every living thing that moves, which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to their kind. God saw that it was good. He blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on earth. Evening and morning were the fifth day. And there's a hint here at what scientists has discovered is the incredible variety of creatures God put in the oceans and in the fresh water. And there's one point where it says, let the waters abound with abundance. There's so many living things. If you get a drop of seawater, it has thousands of microscopic creatures living in it. There's all this stuff, so many different, much different variety. And it bears up, fish multiply faster than most living creatures. You know, they lay thousands of eggs. And there's reference to the birds. The engineering that God put into birds and an individual feather, a scientist has discovered, and it's beyond my, you know, I'm not trained as an engineer, but it's like, it's mind-boggling when you start reading it. And God planned it out and designed it. That's true. They're not even getting into them migrating. As a matter of fact, my wife puts out a feeder for hummingbirds. And this is the time of year they start stoking up because they're like going to go to South America. It's this big. It's going to fly to South America. And then monarch butterflies do that. It's just mind-boggling. It shows, again, God is great. And his capacity and his understanding is just beyond belief. And things like that, again, I'm helped to say, it's like, that didn't happen by chance. Blind random evolution is a poor explanation. I also want to, you can make a reference to 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 39. 1 Corinthians 15, 39, Paul is making a reference to different jobs within the church and different functions, but he, as an analogy, he talks about how there are different kinds of flesh, the flesh of birds, flesh of fish, and of land creatures, reciting the fact that God made different types of meat. Eating fish is different than eating turkey, and both of those are different from eating beef. And most of us know that. If you go to a restaurant, you quickly notice, but it goes right back here to the origin. Speaking of eating beef, verse 24, God shall let the earth bring forth a living creature, the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing, beasts of the earth according to its kind. Three general types of animals are mentioned here. Now, I don't believe God meant this as a taxonomic description. That's where you have animal kingdom, phyla, genera, I don't remember all those things. But we see some general distinctions. Cattle seems to be referring to herbivores, probably, plant-eating animals. Creeping things, I lump all the bugs and worms and reptiles. And beasts might be referring to the predators, the carnivores. Maybe you could break it down differently, but God had different roles in mind. That cycle of life, or what a circle, if you watch The Lion King and sing the song, it didn't evolve. God created it. And, well, we'll discuss. You know, I don't doubt that he's responsible for some animals eating others. There's room to debate when that started, if it starts here or if it starts later. I'll bring that up when we get to it. We're not done on the sixth day. We got all those, but in verse 26, Verses 26 and 27 are very important. When I talk about origin stories, then God said, let us make man in our image. Again, the plural is evident. God, Elohim, so the plural said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let me stop there. It's worth knowing the Hebrew words. Image, the Hebrew is tselem, T-S. Sorry, my memory is this short. T-S-E-L-E-M. And that can refer to shape or representation. You know, sort of the way something looks. Likeness, and this is going to start to look clear and then get confusing, because that's demuth, D-E-M-U-W-T-H. It means resemblance, or manner, or fashion. Okay? In our image and in our likeness, scholars disagree on this. Some say one of these refers to physical appearance, and the other refers to mentality and way of being. Like, we have emotions like God has emotions, and we think, and God thinks. But some say both of these could apply to the physical appearance. And grammatically, they both can. But also, both of these could apply to way of thinking and acting. You could say, well, that's confusing. Or you could say, God made it that way and he had it written that way. So we could say, yeah, we look like God. And there are references in the Bible to him having arms and a head and a torso and legs. But we also have thought process, and we reason. And I mentioned yesterday, God has emotions. God has a sense of humor. God can get sad or upset or angry at things. And he built that into us because he made us like him. He made us in his tselem and demuth, which I'm probably butchering the Hebrew translation. So we could argue which one of these refers to which, or we could be satisfied that we're like God in both ways, while we still fall short of God in so many ways. We might be able to think and reason, but remember, God says, my thoughts are not like your thoughts. I'm as high above you as heaven above the earth. But he wants to raise us up to be like him. We're made in his image and likeness, and doesn't say that about anything else. You know, the cattle reproduce after the cattle kind, the bird after the bird kind. Mankind was made, Mr. Armstrong used to say, after the God kind. And I think that's true. He didn't make any of them to look like him, to act like him, but he made mankind that way. Let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let them, that is mankind, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over the earth, every creeping thing. So God made a difference between man and animals, and guess who he made in charge, so to speak? Man. Man has dominion. So if I want to eat a cow, it's okay. I'm allowed to eat a cow. Now, I'm being kind of facetious. God never intended man to be cruel or what we would say inhumane. We should not make animals suffer needlessly or torture them. I don't believe in killing them because it's fun to kill them. But I also don't go to the extreme of, you know, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, where we talk about animal rights. And they'll have some cases where they say these animals have more right than we do. Well, no, they don't. But I base that on the origins of Genesis, where I believe God made us different and he decided. Because if you take God out of the picture, you could say, yeah, why should I be allowed to eat a cow instead of the cow eating me? What made me better? You know, if cows rise up, or if you see the Planet of the Apes movies, the apes decide they're going to be in charge. If there is no God, that's perfectly fine. But there is a God. There is no Planet of the Apes. It's the Planet of the People, because he gave it to us. Okay, and to finish the thought, I said 26 and 27, because it repeats here, and there's something very important. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God he created him, male and female, he created them. Male and female are both in the image and likeness of God. It's not male is in the image and likeness of God and female in the image and likeness of male. No, no. We will cover how Eve was made from Adam's rib, but both of us are in God's image and likeness. Both male and female have the spirit potential to be children of God. God made different roles in this physical life, and we don't deny that. And you'll in the epistles of Paul, you'll see where God said women aren't to teach or rule over a man, and they don't speak in Sabbath services. But that's not because man is better. In some cases, I think it's that man is inept in some things and needs to work harder at things, needs women. God, and let me, I'll come to you in a second, but one of the things I think is really cool, male and female are both made in the image of God. I think God put some of his characteristics and made them a little more predominant in men, and others of his characteristics he made more predominant in women. So that when a man and a woman are joined in marriage, that's when they're most in the image and likeness of God. And Charlie's nodding his head, he's married. Dr. Sam, you, Josh, those of us that are married here all feel that way. I never thought of that before I was married. I'll be honest, I was this dumb single guy who wanted to, well, I would say play video games, but I didn't do that much. Now, that doesn't mean it's wrong or sinful to be unmarried. It's not being ungodly if you're not married. Things work out for some people and differently for others. But in general, God intended us to mate up and mate for life. And again, it's not that one is in the image and likeness of God and the other isn't. We both are, but we are different. And we're different in more than just the plumbing. We're different in how this works, and God made it that way. Yeah, Charlie?
I think females have bigger brains, too.
I think they do. Well, I know males have fewer connections between the hemispheres. Science has discovered a lot of things, yeah.
My point was when it comes to Paul saying a woman does not have authority to teach or mm-hmm. preach to a man or have any authority to speak in church, it probably has to do with roles. God
exactly.
has given us certain roles. A man has his role, a woman has his role. And when you do these roles as one family, the marriage becomes complete, like you said, and then it becomes, you both become more in the image of God.
Well put, yeah. You can't take a right side and put them together and have a whole. They don't match. You need a right side and a left side. And that's just something that came into my head. But and I don't see any shock or disagreement. Again, I just want to make the point, it goes back here to the beginning, that God created male and female, and he made us, we're both in his image and likeness. I like to stress that because I think it's powerful and important, and we sometimes have tended to overlook that in history and sometimes even in the church, per se. And he blessed them, verse 28, and said, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth." That's one commandment God gave mankind that they have obeyed pretty consistently. Kind of a joke about that. But he also says, "Subdue it, the earth, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over every living thing." So that repeats what I meant. You know, man, human beings have dominion over the other types of creatures. God put man at the top of the food chain, but not to exercise cruelty or arbitrarily just destroy animals. I think it's proper to try to prevent species from going extinct. I'm not keen on saying, oh, we can't build a factory here because there's a brand of toad that lives there. Things like that happen at times. Okay, let's move on. Verse 29. God said, "See, I've given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it will be food. Also to every beast of the earth and every bird of the air, to everything that creeps on earth, in which there's life, I've given every green herb for food." And it was so. Some people have said, and I can't disprove it, that this is saying that God originally made man vegetarian. It doesn't say I gave you the other creatures to eat, so I got to say, yeah, you're right. You know, there's a lot of things Genesis doesn't say. Now, later on, he will specifically say, you can eat these creatures. So whether or not God intended man and animals to be vegetarian at that point, later on there would be a change if that was the case. Because it's very clear eating animals is okay now, and sometimes it's, I don't want to say commanded, but in the process of sacrifice, eating of the sacrificed animals was a command. So man eating animal flesh is something God ordained and set up. To me, it's an interesting academic speculation whether or not it was that way from the beginning. I'll make the point also, because it talks about herb yielding seeds, and some people have speculated, well, does that mean that if a plant doesn't reproduce by seed, we shouldn't eat it? Because what plants don't reproduce by seed, or are there some things? Okay, I'll supply it. I'm thinking of mushrooms. Mushrooms don't come from seeds, but we eat them. Yeah, they're a type of fungus, which sounds kind of gross, but they're delicious on pizza if you get the right ones. Again, I don't think this is particularly a scientific description. God isn't giving dietary laws here. It seems to be a reference to the fact that God doesn't put it, it seems to be indicating he didn't put a distinction between clean and unclean plants in the same way there's a distinction between clean and unclean meats. Some meats he went and said, look, I don't want you to eat that one. You can eat these. He never does that with plants. Now that raises an interesting question. What's the interesting question? Maybe I didn't set up right. Julia? Okay, yeah, why are some plants you can't eat? And I don't know, part of me wonders, like God said, they'll figure it out. You make a salad of poison ivy, you'll figure it out. If you start eating pork, though, it takes a long time to figure it out, and most of mankind hasn't. So I think it might, and this is Frank Dunkel's speculation, I'm not citing chapter and verse, but my speculation is, yeah, he didn't have to tell us what plants we can and can't eat. He trusted us to figure it out, but he realized we wouldn't be able to designate animal life in the same way, and so he would describe that for us. Again, my speculation, but it seems to fit with what we're having here. And God says, okay, any plant that you feel comfortable eating and you can eat, go ahead. At least that's the way I see it. And there are a lot of plants I don't want to eat. When I was a kid, there was a commercial for a type of cereal you don't see much called Grape Nuts. You guys, they had a guy who was a known outdoorsman, and the commercial started off, he said, ever eat a pine tree? Many parts are edible. And nobody's going to eat a pine tree. What are you talking about? That became a joke in my generation. You know, it's like, ever eat a Toyota? Many parts are edible. And but now I've got really sidetracked. Let's get to the end of the chapter, verse 31. Then God saw everything that he'd made, and indeed, it was very good. In the evening and morning were the sixth day. We're not done with the creation week yet, but it's that phrase, it was very good, could also be translated, it was only good. It was superlatively good. You could say it was as good as it could be. Yes, Emily.
Is that different from the other one when it said it was very good, when you said
well,
it was
beneficial?
Well, I think
he does add the very, and so I'm emphasizing the superlative. Okay. Everything was good, so it's sort of like when you get to the end, I put a phrase in my notes, God doesn't make defective merchandise. He made it good. It was well-crafted. He didn't have to go back and do corrections later. If you ever you're at a construction job, later an inspector comes through and creates what's called a punch list, which is all the list of things you got to go back and fix. There was no punch list for the earth and the animals and the birds. God, it was all very good. And then, yeah, we've got 10 minutes left in class, and I said the creation week goes through chapter 2, verse 3, because it said, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. So he's done with all that, but there's another day. It says, and on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested the seventh day from all the work which he had done. It's worth saying, I don't believe God said, whew, man, I want to make some more stuff, but I got to take a day off. I'm exhausted. No, I mean, you've heard that he set an example for us. He stopped working and he rested, not because he was exhausted, but the word there for rested is Shabbat. Some people transliterate it with V's, so that the Hebrew is a little, can be translated either way, but it means he kept a Sabbath. On the seventh day, God Sabbathed, and Sabbath, the root word means seven. So the idea of rest and seven are, in the Hebrew, are linked. The meaning comes together. So on the seventh day, he Sabbathed from the work which he'd done. He rested on the seventh day. Then in verse 3, God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. What does sanctify mean? Yes, yeah, set apart or made holy. If you go to like some church buildings where they have what's called a sanctuary, that means a holy place. Sanctify refers to holiness. Who can make something holy? God can make something holy. We say God can designate something holy. If God is using something, it's holy. His presence makes something holy. Later on, we'll see when God's presence is in that burning bush talking to Moses, he told Moses, take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. Wasn't holy before God was there. So you could say God had put his presence in the Sabbath day, or he made it holy. I'm pausing here because we consider the Sabbath day holy. You know, it's a fundamental belief for us. There are many who call themselves Christians that say, well, you just have to keep some day. Doesn't matter which. You know, just, you know, pick a day, it's fine. No, we say, no, God made, he chose the Sabbath, we don't get to decide. And we believe it's continued. And history bears this up, by the way. You know, you can argue about the calendar and say, oh, the names of the months have changed, different stuff. But the seven-week cycle goes back into antiquity as far as we have records. Interestingly, matter of fact, there's one time where a major government tried to do a change. During the French Revolution, they brought in the decimal system of all things. And while they're doing, instead of inches, they're having centimeters. And instead of Fahrenheit, they have Celsius. They said, let's do that with the week. And so they tried to set up a 10-day week. Didn't stick. People didn't like it. People wouldn't follow it. They went back to the 7-day week. And the same cycle everyone else was on and we've been on. So I'm getting sidetracked. But to say, yeah, God set it up and it's been there ever since. And as far as we know, always will be. God blessed the seventh day, he rested from all the work which he had created and made. I wanted to make a note, you can attach Mark 2:27 as a reference. Mark 2:27 is where Christ was just arguing with the Pharisees, and that's where he said, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. And that also fits here. Man was created on the sixth day, and God made him a Sabbath. Interesting, so the Sabbath was Adam and Eve's first day, so to speak. Well, they had to finish the sixth day. We don't know unless God created them just before sundown. But it goes to show the Sabbath isn't only for if you're tired. How tired can you be from being created? So Adam and Eve started with the Sabbath. And we'll have some time to speculate about some things like, you know, what happened. And I'm pausing. I want to go a little bit further because I don't want to squander time in this class. Questions, thoughts, comments? Okay. Chapter 2, verse 4. I want to go into this enough just to show the distinction because we've had this whole story. Remember, I cited this earlier today when I said, this is the Toldoth. Verse 4, this is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created, and the day that the Lord made the earth and the heavens. So we seem to be starting what might have been Moses quoting from a different document. So we're going to see here a slightly different account of man's creation. It's not contradictory, but it's a different account that tells us some things. Remember I said when a history is somebody's version of what happened? If I asked Nate, what happened here in class yesterday? He would tell me. Then if I asked David, what happened here in class yesterday? He'd tell me a lot of the same things, but some things different. So we get two different accounts here. And like I said, they're not contradictory, but there is some differences. Another thing, in verse 4, Lord God. This is the first place in the Bible we see L-O-R-D in all caps. We discussed yesterday this being what's called the Tetragrammaton. Or the YHWH. Okay, and I discussed here, the meaning of the Hebrew could be self-existing one. It's a derivation of the verb I am, which is, or the verb to be. In English, you know, it's our most irregular verb. And when I studied French, I discovered it's the most irregular verb in French. I don't know, is it in German? Okay, how about Hindi and Telugu? Is the to be verb very irregular?
Yeah.
Okay, the verb to be, like in English, it's I am, you are, we are, he is. So you get am, is, are, was. I don't know why it is that way. But it helps us understand why this word is subject to question, because it's based on the Hebrew of that word. So, but again, it means I am. Later on, Exodus 6 and verse 3 is where God appears to Moses, and Moses asks, well, they're going to ask me what your name is. What do I tell them? Tell them my name is I am. I am that I am. I'll make that reference. And something interesting, because when God talks to Moses, at one point he says, the fathers didn't know me by this name. They just knew me as the Lord God, Adonai, Elohim. But I'm telling you my name is I am. It brings a question, if they didn't know him by that name, what's it doing here in Genesis 2? And there are a couple of different ways to answer that question. And I honestly don't know for sure which one is correct. One answer is that when God said they didn't know me by that name, some people say it means they didn't really understand all that it means. They might have heard the phrase Yahweh or however it's pronounced, but they didn't get it. So that's one explanation. Like they used it, but they didn't understand. Another explanation is that this appears here in Genesis 2 verse 4 because Moses is writing it later, and so he plugs it in, but it wasn't used before. And some would even say maybe Ezra included it when he was doing some edits for the final version. Does that make sense? And again, I'm not committed that one or the other has to be true or false. Yes, Jan?
I've heard an interesting theory that this section could have been written from Adam's perspective. When he wasn't thrown out of as long as he wasn't in the Garden of Eden, he had a close relationship with God, and maybe he could have known his name. But I don't have any proof for this theory.
Yeah, but it's an interesting speculation. Yeah, and again, one of the things I say, when we've got all these things that Genesis doesn't tell us, which is a lot, it leaves questions to say, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And there's no reason we should get at each other's throats and say, well, if you don't believe what I believe, I've got to call you not a Christian or something like that. That's silly to do that. Let's look at what it does tell us and agree to believe it. Now, that's what matters. And I guess I'm not going to get past verse 4 because the bell is about to ring. But that's okay. I wanted to address this, and here it brings us into, we've got a different account, and we see this name of God. And by the way, it's Lord God, so it's Yahweh Elohim, or Yahweh El in many cases. Sometimes you'll see Adonai Elohim. There's different combinations in Hebrew, and going through the names of God is something to discuss in another time and place, but it permeates the Bible. And it's one of the things that tells me God wouldn't use all these different names and different pronunciations of them if he was so hung up that we've got to pronounce it a certain way. There are groups that say, if you don't pronounce it this way, God won't listen to your prayer. And I kind of have trouble with that. Yes, Jan.
We have Jesus' example in the New Testament. When the disciples asked him how to pray, he said, Our Father in heaven.
Yeah, so what do you want to call God? Father. And that could be said in whatever language.